Recording to cloud is typically something they set up right when they initiate the Zoom meeting.
Like, okay. Okay. Whether it's kind of the default that it looks like it. Okay.
That's perfect. Windows 7 boot disk.
It showed up like on here, an E and an E.
Yeah.
I saw the E one first and it wouldn't let me.
All right, it's all you, man.
Yep, good. Thank you. Thank you.
Saw myself on.
Yeah, that's not right. Wes, that's, you were just teasing me.
It was laundry day.
Todd, you bully.
Maybe that was my imagination, you know. There's no proof, no evidence.
No evidence at all.
Todd, can you share the screen?
Does anybody know how to work Zoom? I'm kidding. How long have we been doing this? All right, I think we'll get started. Thank you for those here in the room for joining us, and thank you for those joining us via Zoom. Hopefully you can hear me and see the room and see the screen. So we have a possibly fairly light agenda for today, but important topics that we want to address. So I'm going to start off and just hit a variety of miscellaneous items. And then we're going to move to some important updates dealing with the external pay and international travel and telework. So some important policies just to make sure that everybody's aware of those. And then we'll wrap up with some of the Gillings Inclusive Excellence Climate Survey. So as far as some of the items that I want to address, we do have an update in terms of our admissions. And so specifically for the graduate programs, you can see some of the numbers here. So a summary of both the total number of applications as well as broken down by both our MS and the PhD. You can see these are big numbers. And let me see if I can make that smaller. There we go. And so again, I think this is a record in terms of the number of applications that we've received. And again, you can see again in terms of the master's and the PhD, and then again a breakdown in terms of U.S. citizen, permanent resident, as opposed to those foreign nationals. And so we believe that we're close to the targets. And so you can see a little bit, I know that's small, but if you were able to see that, we have the MS numbers on the left-hand side and the PhD numbers on the right-hand side. And you can see both the number of applications as well as the number that we have enrolled. Again, in terms of meeting those targets, we think we're on track. And again, you can see historically, we seem to be pretty much consistent with what we've been aiming for. With a little bit of that exception in terms of the MS program immediately post-COVID and then sort of the bounce back after that. So again, thank you to the admissions committee. It's been a lot of work, a lot of applications to review. So thank you to them. I also want to give a little update about our undergraduate summer internship program. So we have this busy program. So a reminder about that, it's already underway. So I'll talk a little bit about how it's looking for the summer, but keep this in mind for future summers if it piques your interest. So in terms of the 2024 program, you can see we had 23 applicants. These are our undergraduates, our BSPH students. We had 7 open positions or internships that were offered by 5 different faculty members. So again, if you are interested in joining this for next year, make sure you're keeping track of that when the call goes out. I think that's kind of early spring usually. So we have a lot more undergraduates that are interested than we're actually able to accommodate. So the way this works is there's sort of a committee. They try to do some matching to make sure that you have multiple applicants to choose from. You can see their qualifications, see maybe who the best matches are. And then the faculty member can sort of reach out and even do interviews or whatever seems to be best, find the hopefully optimal match and offer that and then sort of iterate until convergence. And again, there's a variety of ways that this can look. It can be something that requires sort of full-time work. It can be something that's, you know, not full-time, more of a part-time. And again, it can be something that's funded or not funded. So again, a lot of flexibility depending on what the opportunity is. I'll speak from my experience. I'm one of the 5 that offered an opportunity, but a lot of these students, even if you don't have funding, they're very eager to be able to participate and get this type of experience. As far as the formal structure of that program, in June, they host this committee hosts a kickoff event and the internships begin. And then about halfway through in mid-July, there's sessions in terms of getting them ready for the symposium, which occurs at the end of July or early August. And so we have this end of summer research symposium. If you haven't seen this before, it's actually very well done. They typically have it in the atrium or in the basement of the atrium in the Hooker Research Center. And these students are excited to share the work that they've done. So they have posters and they're standing there to interact. And so that will be advertised. And again, we encourage people to come out and interact with the undergraduate students. I want to talk a little bit about travel policy updates from the departmental standpoint. We're going to also talk about that from a broader perspective here on the next agenda item. But in terms of issues that maybe we've seen within the department or issues to avoid, I want to give a reminder about Concur. So I typically joke that Concur is the hardest part of my job, but I'm only joking slightly. So remember that when you have the receipt, especially when it comes to food, we need to have itemization. Okay, so I'll show you a couple of examples on the next slide, but there needs to be itemization. So exactly what was ordered is shown on that receipt. And if not, then there's going to be a request for that itemized receipt. If you don't have it, there are some additional steps involved. And even if you're able to go through those additional steps, that that request may or may not be approved. So bottom line, best idea is to get the itemized receipt. And here are some examples. So on the left-hand side, you can see the itemization where the different menu items are listed. And then on the right-hand side, you can see the ones that are not acceptable because they basically just show a total charge and then there would be some follow-up there. Also, in terms of the travel requests, you want to include information about the funding source. So if you recall in Concur, they will have different places to add things like codes and fund numbers and so on. And if you have those, that's great. But if not, at least make sure that you include some information about what source it is the most specific way that you can list that in the comments, and I'll show you where that is on the next slide. Also, if it's international travel, it's a bit more involved. And so you want to make sure that you're looking into this special approval form, request form, and make sure that you have everything sort of lined up for that. And again, you just need to be careful in terms of being reachable. So if there are questions, they're going to reach out and make sure that you're getting the right source of funds. And if not, you can see that it would default to educational funds. So here are some of those forms. Again, you can see that this one has different sources filled out. But if you don't have that, what we see at the bottom of the screen is a place where you can enter the comments and make sure that you have specified the source of those funds. This is something that we wanted to make sure is clear. This is not new. This is not something we're introducing today, but just a reminder about the university's policy. So dealing internationally and specifically with China, we need to keep in mind what we have here in bold, that we're not allowed to conduct any remote work for research while abroad in China. And that includes GRA work. Okay, so make sure if this affects you that you have, you're aware of the policy, and if there's anything that seems unclear of what's permissible and not, make sure you're checking with the appropriate authorities. And again, this is not something that we've made up, and it's not something new, but you can see sort of where this is coming from in terms of the university policy. Yeah.
So in China, it's not
okay. So again, thank you for that, Scott. So if you're doing international travel, probably best just to check in and find out sort of what's permissible and what's not, and make sure if it's whether one of those countries. Yeah.
I'll just add some personal experience. They seem to be denying research on studies that are funded other than the federal government or NIH. Now, there's a very limited set of activities that appear to be permitted if it's not like NIH or federally funded, but those don't seem to include remotely accessing research data.
Okay. Okay. So, so there might be some exceptions, or there might be, may or may not be issues. So again, I think the clearest thing is probably to check in and make sure that whatever you have planned is going to be permissible, and you're not going to run into any issues. Again, this is not a new policy, but it's just a reminder of what we have in place.
Basically, any federal contract or grants can be considered research, and so travel under that would not be allowable. But if it's for funds that aren't a grant, if it's others, that opens up the possibility that it might not be briefly. So there's a little bit more leeway there as far as what's they'll allow them through as far as a grant, not a grant for going
I think what Todd is referencing is also not just the travel there, but also the remote work aspect of like remotely connecting, teleworking too, which is kind of an issue. And I think it's also important to say that GRA work that he's referencing is just work part of it. So
So thank you. And so I'm going to keep moving for now, because we're going to come back to this with someone who's much more knowledgeable. So hopefully it will become clearer than mud.
Todd, Joe Brahim, unless you need the time, I have one more comment about
please go ahead.
Travel, not about the China thing, but the so recently sort of some of us encountered this, is that if you do a CONCUR request for international travel and you have to travel on a weekend because, let's say, a short course or whatever that you're giving, as JSM, for example, a lot of short courses are on Sunday morning and stuff like that. And, you know, that affects some of us. And I know Aretha is in the room, but she can clarify anything that I said. Apparently, you have to do a cost comparison to sort of demonstrate that had you flown out on a weekday, not a weekend, it would have been more expensive than flying out on a weekend. So, like, for example, if I'm giving a JSM short course on a Sunday, typically I'd fly out on Saturday, which is a weekend. And then, so if you're going to do that, then CONCUR might ask you for a cost comparison. Had you flown out on Friday, would it have been more expensive? Aretha, correct me if I'm wrong on this. And this is for international travel only, Aretha, or any kind of travel within the U.S. as well?
No, any kind of travel, because UNC does not consider the weekday, the weekend, work days. And so they typically question when you're flying over the weekend someplace because it's not considered a work day. So they're just international work.
Okay, yeah, so could you repeat that, Todd? Because
yes,
I had to be online today, and yeah. So I didn't hear exactly what Aretha.
Yeah,
Aretha
thank you, said. And this hopefully will help the others on Zoom as well. So what Aretha said is that it doesn't matter whether it's domestic or international that applies, and the rationale for that is that the university doesn't consider the weekend to be work days.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. I just wasn't aware of that, and so. I'm not complaining or anything. I'm just saying that maybe other people aren't aware of that. I just didn't know. It's just a heads up for people that are thinking of traveling over a weekend instead of a weekday, I guess. Yeah. It's not a big deal, but I didn't know about it.
Yep. Great. Thank you. And so the last thing I want to say is just a reminder of next week's Greenberg lectures. So super important that we have a good showing in person. So as many as you as possible, please try to be there. There are three. Try to make as many as you can and show our departmental interest in this. So thank you for that. I'm going to turn this over to Jamie O'Brien. We're going to come back to this point about international travel. But also this external pay for professional activities. So again, something that you want to make sure that you're aware of the different policies that apply. You're just going to talk or?
No, I have slides. I emailed them to you. Do you have your email on here by any chance? Does that have my email? Oh, yeah.
You want both of them?
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
Okay, we're almost there. One did you want to start with?
We can start with that one since we were already talking about it.
Okay, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to steal your thunder.
No, you're totally fine. It's something kind of everyone's been talking about recently. I think I scared people maybe when I sent out a couple of emails recently about travel and telework. Hi, I'm Jamie. I am the research compliance coordinator for all of Gillings. If you didn't know, I coordinate research compliance. If you have any questions about compliance, whether it be travel, export, IRB, IACUC, authorship, publication, anything research ethics-y, my background is in bioethics and research ethics, and I am happy to answer questions or get you in contact with anybody here at the university who I have resources or I have connections with. I live down in the first floor of Rosenau in the It used to be Research Innovation and Global Solutions. Now we're just kind of our own little research office, but we don't have a name yet. But I work with Alexia Kelly and Carrie North, who is our new ADR. And I'm always happy to help. I will send out both of these resources when I'm back in my office to Todd, who I'm sure will disseminate to everybody here. So recently I think telework and international travel has been kind of a question for everyone. The first big question that I've kind of been getting from a lot of people has been the difference between the travel authorization and then this telework form, because there are two separate forms. So the travel authorization that happens in Concur and then this telework for teleworking abroad with research are two different forms. So this one is found in Connect Carolina, and this one is really, really important when you're traveling internationally, because this one goes to what is called the Global Working Group. The Global Working Group is comprised of all of the really important offices here at UNC who need to see where you're going, what you're taking with you, what kind of research you do, whether or not you are doing research when you're over there, which is to say, when you are going there, you don't necessarily have to be doing research. You don't even necessarily have to be working to fill out this telework request. If you are going and you are going to bring your phone and you are going to send some emails and you are going to check some emails and you're going to email someone about your NIH grant, it would be really great if we knew that, especially if you're going to China or Vietnam or places that we're a little concerned about right now. You know, if you're going somewhere that is of, you know, major concern to us, absolutely, we definitely need to know. We call it the telework request form. Telework isn't really all that defined. Telework can mean you're checking your emails, you're sending a couple of like bounce back emails, like we're doing this, we're doing that. We really want to know where you are. We want to know where your data is and all that kind of stuff. But it also, of course, means if you're going there to just work from abroad, you're not going there to do your research, that would have obviously a telework authorization or a international abroad authorization where you go through Concur and you're getting funds. And that's really what the Concur form is for, is that your funds are going through to pay for that trip and then you're going to get reimbursed. And that's really nice because then you don't have to pay for it. This is more, we know where you are, payroll knows where you are. You know, if you're over there for too long, sometimes they're gonna be like, hey, are you ever coming back? University Council knows where you are. If you get arrested while you're in, you know, Stockholm, we should know that. Export compliance knows where you are. If, you know, while you're arrested, somebody steals your laptop, that's a problem. Science and security, That's going to be a big one, especially if you are traveling to countries of concern, or if you're traveling somewhere and you do very high risk research. My research, apart from the university, I have a second job at UMass. I study gain of function research, which is very interesting, but is high risk research. So I have to do some special things to protect my research. That is an important thing to think about when you are going places with your laptop. Some other things to think about are the telework request form is going to go through a number of reviews. So as soon as you think that you're going to go somewhere, it would be really great if you got started on that review. It's not something that we want to do 48 hours in advance and say, hey, I'm going to China on Sunday. It's Thursday. Please get this through all of these people. Have we done it? Yes. Do we like to do it? No, not really. So yeah, so this can be found in Connect Carolina, and you can go through. It's going to first be sent to your department review, then it's going to be sent to your our HR. Here it's going to be, or it's going to be sent to your supervisor, and it's going to be sent to department HR, and then it's going to be sent to Robert downstairs, who is taking over for Gretchen right now. And then we will send it off to the global working group. Then it will be sent back to Robert, and then it will be sent back to you guys. And we will either say you're good to go, or we'll say, hey, these are the steps that we have to take to mitigate risk. And it's very rarely like a flat out, no, we can't do this. But sometimes it is like, hey, these are the steps we have to take, or you can't do X, Y, Z when you go, but you can do all of your other things. But yeah, so if you have any questions about this form in particular, it is in addition to your Concur form, because the Concur form is you get your money back, your department knows where you're going, your department knows how much you're going to spend. This is the rest of everybody knows where you are. The rest of everybody knows where your research is, where your laptop is. And it also will ask if you're bringing any other research equipment with you. If you have like, I don't know, 8,000 test tubes you want to bring with you to Stockholm, sure, why not? That's something that they're going to ask you. So, right, if you have any questions, just, yeah. Not really. The thing about this form is that it is new, because we have not been greatly in compliance. And that's why I'm going around kind of pushing this information on people, is that we really, I mean, I don't know how many of you guys have been completing this in the past couple of years. I don't think that we've seen a ton of them come through the office. We especially haven't been seeing them for like in addition to people who are submitting international authorizations. So, I mean, it's kind of a forgiveness in the after step, but now that we're kind of ramping up education, we would really like people to comply. I think the penalties would come is if we were to do something that is against federal law or federal policy, like take NIH data to China and then do things with it and then come back and then the government be like, hey, did your science and security officer know about this? Where was the clearance for this? And we were like, we don't know. So there are penalties, surely. But we would like to just stay in compliance across the board for everybody and not have to worry about picking and choosing who we're gonna penalize. Yeah. Yeah.
Is this required for any person that is traveling internationally to put in the international travel request? This is something that has to accompany the request of those people.
Mm-hmm. Even if they're not doing the Concur. So even if they're traveling not on UNC money, even if they're just going on vacation and they're going by themselves, but they're just like, if they're attending conferences, if they're going on vacation, even if they're not on work time, if you've submitted PTO and you're still saying, I want to take my laptop, or I'm going to take my phone and I'm still going to reply to some emails, it's good to submit this, then we know. It's better to be safe than not know at all. Yes. Yeah. It'll be completed by the traveler in Connect Carolina. Yep. Yep. And it will be automatically routed to you, and then it'll go out, circle around campus, back to you. Yep.
For any level of travel, you know, because you know we have the level 1, 2.
Yep. And the mitigation steps will be based on kind of where those are, on how risky it is going to be. Anything else? Does that make sense? Great.
That means no one can contact me.
Nope, you got to do it inside your own Connect Carolina. And you can put even in the form, there's like notes or something. You can say like, I'm going on PTO, might check my email while I'm out there. And that will also like decrease the amount of risk mitigation. Or if you're saying like, I'm not really conducting my research while I'm out here, they'll understand. It does. Yep, it does. All right. Everyone's other favorite, which is EPAPs. This is the time of EPAP renewal season. If you didn't know already, I'm going to get into what an EPAP is. But if you have an EPAP and you didn't know, just like IRBs, EPAPs have renewal time, and it is at the end of every fiscal year. So June 20-something-ish, you're going to get an email, and it's going to say, hey, July 1st, it's going to open, and you're going to have to submit every EPAP that is still happening for you has to be submitted all over again. If you're still continuing that activity, you're going to have to do it again. And I'm going to say that probably 3 more times in this presentation, because it doesn't ever stick for at least like 3 people in this entire school. My disclosure is that I have no financial interests except my job, but not technically in this EPAP. The recommended time to disclose any relationship or financial interest is in the beginning of your talk. And that's because if you do it at the end, it might change everyone's mind about what you just said. So an external professional activity for pay. Has everyone filled one of these out already? Has someone not filled one of these out? Does someone have no EPAPs? Cool. 2 people? 3 people? Awesome. All right. Are you guys the HRA? Faculty? You guys faculty? Okay, awesome. So we have people who have not completed the process. We will indoctrinate you into EPAP society. So EPAPs are any activity that are not included in your university employment responsibilities, which we will get to in a second. They are performed for any entity, public or private, other than the university itself. They are undertaken for compensation, which has a little bit of a caveat. And they are based upon the professional knowledge, experience, and ability of the EHRA employee. So 2 things with that. First, research cannot be an EPAP if someone is paying you to do something that is considered research. It has to be under a subcontract. I'm very sorry. I know that that is somewhat difficult, and it's hard when they're only $1,000 subcontracts, and you want it to be an EPAP because getting a subcontract for less than, you know, $5,000 is kind of like it's a difficult process to go through OSP, and that takes a long time. But it's not even like a school or a university thing. That's like above us. They have decided that the powers that be, EPAPs are not research. Also, as far as undertaken for compensation is usually monetary. However, per university council, building equity in a startup is a form of compensation. So if you start a company, you must submit an EPAP, even though you are not necessarily getting any monetary value from it yet. So usually If you meet with Ann Glauber, who would be the one who is helping you start a company here at UN, at Gillings, you'll meet with her, and then you'll also probably meet with me or Alexia about the COI process. And we'll say, hey, the COI process happens when you think you're going to start making money, because you'll have a financial conflict of interest. We have a $0 threshold here for disclosing that financial conflict of interest. However, once you have equity in a startup, you have to submit an EPAP because you are having an external professional activity outside of the university that is being undertaken for some sort of compensation, which is that equity. And it's some sort of knowledge or experience that you have here that is not included with the university. It's not your university responsibilities. It's not anything. It's like taking off your UNC hat and putting on your company hat. So if you have any questions about that, if you are thinking about starting a company and you're like, I don't understand that at all, just let me know and I'm happy to help out with that one. I think everyone in here is probably EHRA faculty or EHRA non-faculty, but if you are SHRA, I will just say that it is judged differently. SHRA does not have EPAP. They have something, I'm SHRA, they have something called like a second job contract that you sign. EHRA non-faculty is based on a job description. And then EHRA faculty are judged on like what is considered a university duty. So there are specific university responsibilities, institutional responsibilities that you have. You have primary, secondary, and then non-institutional responsibilities. And we'll go over those in a second. EHA non-faculty, when you apply for a job, you have a job description that you're judged off of when you do like your performance reviews. Your EPAP will be judged off of, you know, if your professional activity for pay is close enough to that, what your professional activities are in that. So if you are EHRA non-faculty and you do BIOS research on, I don't know, I'm not a numbers person, on lots of numbers, but your second job is going to be selling soaps at Lush, which I do know someone does, that's not probably going to have to be an EPAP. I think you'll be okay because those two things are not going to be judged too closely. But if you're going to be doing running numbers for the company of Lush, perhaps we get into a little bit of a flux there. So these are the institutional responsibilities. These are your primary, secondary, and then what are considered external activities. So your primary, scholarship, research, institutional services, and administrative. It gets a little bit more murky as we go into institutional secondaries, because these also start to look like things that can be external if they're done for specific places, or can be secondary if they're done for government or they're done for, you know, nonprofits or things like that. So professional associations and learned societies, review or advisory panels, presentations of lectures, presentations and seminars, reviewing, service to accreditation bodies. And then external activities, if you're getting paid for consulting on a nonprofit, like I said, if you're getting paid for consulting on, I don't know, the U.S. vaccine board for the government, probably maybe not an EPAP. We'll look at it. We'll see. Maybe it's related to your job well enough that we could call that a secondary. Yeah.
So I can confirm, Jamie, because this is very educational for me.
Yeah.
But looking at those secondary institutional responsibilities,
mm-hmm.
a lot of what we do as faculty seem to fall under that banner,
mm-hmm.
Such as reviewing on NIH panels,
mm-hmm.
Speaking at a professional society or a nonprofit organization,
mm-hmm.
maybe giving, you know, lecture trainees, training programs, that kind of thing. And also serving on data safety and monitoring boards, which typically have a very nominal fee, you know, like besides expenses, if you have to travel, maybe $250 to $500. But it's, all these things are time commitments and usually not a whole lot of compensation. And those are part of our faculty review, reviews and expectations. Oh. I've been confused because I thought that these things were EPAPs.
So a DSM,
are you telling me they're not?
Being paid for a DSMB is an EPAP, but it depends on what they are labeling it. If you are being labeled giving your talk to a trainee as a consultant, if they're saying you're going to be a consultant for AAMC coming in as a biostatistician and you're going to, you know, train these people for $1,000, then you're a consultant for the nonprofit and that is an external activity.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah. So that falls under the external activity of consulting for a nonprofit.
It's a one-off. And this is,
even if it's just
to give you a real example.
Yeah.
So I go occasionally to the Alzheimer's Association. They have a 3-day program where they're training junior researchers. So it's pretty much, it's only for those 3 days and only to give a presentation and to have a few one-on-one meetings on their general research topic. I mean, that's not an ongoing relationship. It's a 3-day event that might happen annually. Is that an, but I get, it has pay, so is that an EPAP?
I think, so a presentation of a lecture, I think it would depend on what your contract says and where it is and who is funding it.
Yes,
yeah, right.
It's like United States based. It's not a conference, right?
Yeah, United I think States it's usually
a group of maybe 20 or 30 junior researcher trainees that are invited to participate in this program.
Yeah, I think I probably could have written this a little bit clearer. So that would still, I think, fall under external activities. The secondary activities that are presentations of lectures and papers usually are at conferences or at other schools, like an invited lecture, or if, like, you know, a med school wants to pay you to come and do an honoraria for like a one-off lecture or something like that. But if it is like a company, if it is like something,
but it's a nonprofit, it's the Alzheimer's Association.
It's still, so yeah.
We're really cutting them.
I understand. And here's the other thing about this. As I said, I am an ethicist, and my favorite line to do in any type of thing is, it depends. It really just depends. Unfortunately for me, because it gives me a job, is that for a lot of these, if you send me an email, this is my job. And I can be like, yeah, let me look into it. I'll email someone and I'll get into it. So if you really are like, okay, I don't know if this is what I need to fill out an EPAP for, I'm very confused on like where the line is blurry, you can send me the details and I will look into it and I will scour the policy to see where it is. But as far as I can read from that, if you are being paid by a nonprofit, that is where the line is. The line says, if it's a consultancy for a nonprofit, then it's external. If you're being paid by a US university to present like a lecture or at a conference or something like that, then it's a responsibility under the institutional, like, you know, you're contributing to the field of knowledge and you're helping collaboration and that kind of thing.
Thank you. I can just share, if you haven't done an EPAP, it's not very burdensome.
Thank you for that. Yeah. it's not all that. Yeah.
So I think you mentioned this, but if you do some of these, especially in that middle column, and there is an honorarium, you don't need to do EPAP at all.
Yeah. There are some secondary responsibilities that do include honorariums. Sometimes, you know, you'll get money for reviewing on an advisory panel. Sometimes you'll get money for, you know, giving like $50 for giving a talk over at Duke. Like, it does happen. Just shoot us an email. We'll make sure that it falls under your secondary institutional responsibilities. But for the most part, it usually falls under institutional, as long as it's a US. One, Here's the thing with that, though, is you might have to fill out a conflict of interest form because now you're getting money from a different institution, and then you might have to fill it out under, depending on how much you get, you might have to put it under your other support documents on your bio sketch and other support. So it's a toss up between which forms you have to put it on now. But yeah, so if you have any questions or you get an invitation to give a talk for some amount of money and you don't really know where to put it or where it falls for these, just like I said, shoot me an email. I'm happy to kind of parse it out for these things. Yeah, like I said, primary responsibilities, not allowed to be an EPAP. So research, institutional or service, administrative, university channels. So research has to go through, this says OSR, it's an old slide. OSP, if I'm very sorry about that. your secondary generally don't need to be disclosed unless you are engaging with a foreign government or a foreign university. Like I said, they can have an honorarium. If they are like saying, we're going to give you $50,000 to come talk at NC State, please reach out. Let's have a little talk about why and what you're talking about and who's going to be there. We would love to know. And then you have to disclose any external activities in relation to the expertise of these your institutional duties. To determine if it constitutes research, you can think about what an NIH person defines as an investigator. That it gets a little murky when it starts to talk about whether things are research, if they are publishable, or whether you know ahead of time if it's publishable. These questions have begun to come up more in the secondary institutional responsibilities, like if you're going into like an advisory panel or you're participating in an association that might have a white paper come out and the white paper might be published. That gets a little bit murky. So if you go into one of these and you're like three meetings in and they're like, oh, maybe we should write a paper on this, reach out, happy to talk about it. You know, it's not that you went in and you were like, I'm going to deceive the people of UNC. No, it's fine. It's not a big deal. We can look at it. We can grant grace in any of these. We're not concerned. So the EPAP process, you're going to submit it via the AIR system, which if you've done a COI disclosure, if you've, I'm going to say this and I'm going to hope that nobody looks like I've caught them like a deer in headlights. If you've assigned any of your books in your class, hopefully you have used the self-authored course material guidelines, which are also in AIR. I'm going to close my eyes now. That is also in AIR. Disclosures must be made 10 days before starting the activity or more, if you would like to give us a little bit of a running start. For an ongoing activity, new disclosures must be made each year. So the new year will start in July. So if you have one that's going to be continuing, if you have one that started in the beginning of June, you got to do it again in the beginning of July. I'm very sorry. We don't make the rules. The review is going to be done by the department. The department is responsible for the initial review. I'm not going to call out who does it, but there is someone who probably is on this Zoom who does your reviews. And then the additional review, depending on the nature of the activity, might include someone like Tech Transfer, the Office of the Provost, who is like the overseer of EPAPs, and then HR. Tech Transfer would be like if you have IP involved in your EPAP. And then you get an approval letter, which will be sent to you if there's any issues. Prior to that, you'll probably get an email from me or Alexia or maybe even Michael. Yeah, so these are some resources. Like I said, I will send my slides and then the travel resource, which is from OVCR, not from me. They did a great job on that, to Todd. And then hopefully Todd can get that out to all of you guys. And if you have any questions, my information is on this last slide. So thanks. I don't have any questions. Yeah.
DSMBs. I don't understand why DSMBs, NIH DSMBs specifically, are on this. That the compensation for that is exactly the same as an NIH study section. And it's really a professional service which falls under our duties, a secondary kind of duty. So it's not for a pharmaceutical company DSMB, it's an NIH DSMB.
Has someone told you that the NIH DSMB is?
Well, it doesn't specify whether it's NIH or other DSMB.
Just... I think if it's a government DSMB, it might be exempt from the DSMB.
All right.
I'm unsure. Let me check with Joy on that. Yeah, if it's funded by the federal government, it might have an exemption. I can check with Joy on that one. Right. I'm actually not positive about that.
Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Talking about paid for in this context, though, this is largely about like if a pay would be to a person individually and not to the university. Is that largely?
So, kind of. If they are saying that they are going to pay the university, I think it would end up going under a conflict of interest form, which would still need to be filled out in AIR. But I don't think it would go under an EPAP. It would be like an institutional conflict of interest to that way. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
So the theme of the day so far is all the murky, blurred, gray areas. So we'll move to our next item. And Kim Ramsey-White has joined us. She's the Associate Dean for Inclusive Excellence. And she's going to share some items on that topic with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Chad. Hello, everybody. So I have some information. I think you all know we did a climate study. Do I need to talk in there? Okay. We did a climate study last year, 2023, spring of 2023. And throughout the fall semester and pretty much into the fall semester, an outside organization did it, BA Consultants. And we did some focus groups as well. We got a final report on that the beginning of the fall semester. And we've been trying to share information. We did a presentation to faculty and staff at the faculty and staff meeting. We did a community conversation around the results. Did anybody have a chance to attend any of those? You did, Todd? So, in addition, we've also shared all of the data and the reports with all of the department chairs. So Michael has the information that's specific to biostatistics. I can talk a little bit today about kind of what we got overall at the school level. And then hopefully, I think Michael and I will have a chance to maybe work together. He's supposed to kind of look at all of the BIOS data and summarize it and then present it to you all. And I can probably give him a hand in doing that. So we had over 100, we had 778 total participants for the climate study. So it was about a 28 to 30% participation rate across the school. So a lot of people would be like, oh, that's not really very many people when you stop and think about how many people there are at the school. And that could be a very legitimate, very technical admission. But the things that came out of the climate study are not things that were, oh my God, where did that come from? We've never seen that before. How did that get there? When did that happen? The things that came out of our climate study that we need to focus on in terms of our school are things that have been in our Gillings student, staff, faculty survey. They, over the past couple of years, they've come out in terms of our feedback forms. So there wasn't anything in the survey that, you know, kind of caught us off guard or made us feel like, wow, we didn't even realize that was happening. And in the aggregate, really, it's about the climate of our school and about how people feel about them being able to share their individual perspectives about things, about how safe people feel in their units and in their departments. Are there good things that we're doing at the school? Absolutely, there are good things that we're doing at the school as well. And even when we look at the Gillings data and the climate survey data, if you just look at the percentages of people who, you know, said they weren't happy with something or something along those lines, those percentages don't ever really look more than about 18 to 20% of who participated in that particular survey. The question is, if 18 or 20% of the people who did participate in the survey, so that could be anywhere from 10 people to 30 people, depending on the numbers of who participated, feel like they don't feel safe in their classroom, does it mean that we should not pay attention to it because it's just 10% of our students who don't feel safe? And I just use that as an example. And I'm sharing that because that's how we've gone about trying to think about looking at the results of our climate survey. Not really whether or not a large number of people, you know, feel this way. And so many of the things that came out, even if we had one student who felt like, I can't sit in my class and be able to share my experiences because I'm afraid I'm gonna get my head chopped off because I think differently than the other people in my classroom do. That's not what we want for any of our students, not even one of our students. What do we want that for? And are we ever going to maybe get to a place where we eliminate all of that together? We might not, but we at least need to know that we're trying to make sure that people feel like they're in a place and in a space where they can intellectually be able to grow and to be able to share their perspectives. So I was just going to talk about a couple of the things that came out. Let me just tell you a little bit about the demographics of the people who did participate. So I told you we had 778 people overall, 12 administrators, 180 faculty, less than 5 postdocs, 200 staff, and 383 students, which combines graduate and undergraduate students. The big themes that came out as far as the students were concerned were some of the things I've already mentioned, that there was limited safe space for diverse views, that people felt afraid to talk about things in their classrooms for fear of reprisal or retaliation, that people felt concerns about their identity and diversity. And in the focus groups, that kind of came out more in terms of identity and diversity, meaning that they didn't see a lot of diversity in the teachers and in the leadership, and that they wanted more as far as that was concerned. The identity piece, while it's not 100% clear, we think is really more related to LGBTQ faculty and students students in this case that responded to the survey. One of the other things that was really interesting is we asked a question around microaggressions, and students felt like they some experienced it, but a lot more felt like they observed microaggressions in their classrooms, whereas faculty felt like there were very little microaggressions that took place in their classrooms. So what could be the cause for that? Well, I'll tell you, it's because we define microaggressions. People have different determinations about what a microaggression is. And so that's another thing that we've been trying to think, that we've thought about trying to do in terms of just education for for the school is let's get some common definitions for things. And that's a big issue, given everything that we're facing right this second in terms of how the work around inclusion and climate and everything is really in a place to not exist in the context of us having somebody to actually lead the work. And to be at a place where we know that there are these challenges as far as people making sure that people understand things in the same way, but nobody really to lead the work of helping us to get to a better place of that. Do you think we'll get better with these things on our own, or do you think they'll get worse? Not better. Don't know? No?
I think there needs to be discussion, right? Engagement about it.
Yep. But if we don't have it, right, it's not going to get better on its own. That's kind of what my point is. So I can keep talking about some of these things, but I don't think I'd be telling you too much of anything that you don't already know that you haven't already heard. If there's anything in terms of what I feel is important for me to do over the next however many days, weeks, months, I continue to be here, it is really to drive home the point that the challenges that we face in our, and I'll speak here because we're talking in the department, in our classrooms, and not just in our classrooms, even amongst the relationships that we have with each other, amongst faculty and staff relationships, amongst faculty and faculty relationships, the different dynamics that there are in terms of the hierarchy of power. All of those things are important. And if there's not an inclusive excellence office in Giddings to come and stand in front of you in the classroom to be able to say, hey, here's something that we're trying. We want you to participate in this. Who's going to do it? How will each department make a determination, knowing that we all are in agreement that this work is important, but it has to get done and somebody has to do it. And at the end of the day, I can't even tell you that we'll be here to continue to help do that work. That's not something that I can say that we will be here to do. And if we're not, somebody has to take it up. It's not going to just be like, oh, well, it'll get better by itself. It has to be something that stays at top of mind if it's important for you as a department. Yeah. So I think I would just go from there and just see if you all have any other questions of me that I could potentially answer for you.
So obviously this is an important topic, and keep your eyes open for additional opportunities to have some of these discussions, both at the school and departmental level. But any last questions? Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And with that, we'll adjourn. Thank you all for coming.
And Todd? Yeah.
Yes, please.
Could I make just one announcement? Sorry. I know Michael would have done it, but he's out of town. I just wanted to let everybody know, people may not know, that we have some sad news. Ethan Ault is resigning his position, or he's moving to another position at GSK in Matt Sciotta's group, and he will be here until mid-July. And obviously, we're all very sad to see Ethan go. At the same time, we want the best for him, but he will be a huge loss in the department. I don't know if you even knew that, Todd, but sorry to interject that. I'm not pulling an Alexander Haig on you or anything like that, but I think people should know because Ethan is not going to be with us much longer, unfortunately.
Right. Thank you. And again, we'll end there, but hope everyone has a good summer and keep your eyes open for the next meeting. So thank you all.
Bye, everybody.